Well, hello and welcome back to the Archaeology News Weekly. I am, of course, your host, David Connolly. And I'm not even going to say that it's a come down since podcast 200 because, of course, it just gets better and better. And this good news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. Stories have been collected from various sources. And, of course, to see these sources and view the details in each story, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. So let's get started with podcast 201. We've got evidence of mass production being found in Israel and a report on Australia's rock art. Hard to find places, amazing treasures to be found. Bulgarian man, of course, stumbles across an ancient treasure. Well, I'm thinking that's interesting story. I might or I might not actually talk about it. There's continent's orientation hindering ancient settlement in the Americas, and an unexpected trove of artifacts has been discovered near Stonehenge. A massive prehistoric monument has been found, or is it, beneath the waters of the Loch of Stennis up in Orkney, and we report on Paleolithic stone tools found in Sri Lanka. Children learn to finger paint in the Paleolithic age. Well, you decide. And dropping lake levels expose ancient texts and artifacts to looters. There's new conservation efforts at Göbekli Tepe and a request for Israel to return Bronze Age pottery to Jordan. Ancient New Mexican sites reopen after a large fire and, wait for it, a flood as well. And we're looking for volunteers to help collapse a replica broch up in the north of Scotland. We then head back over to Wyoming, where an ancient site may have had year-round residents, and then back into Jordan again, where the secrets of their wetlands are exposed. Honestly, wetlands in the deserts of Jordan. Then prehistoric settlement has been discovered in Turkey, and we finish off with rock art found in Ireland, dating back to the Bronze Age. Remember, of course, you can be listening to this on your Stone Pages Archaeo News app, as well as keeping up with the latest news as it happens. So let's get started with today's podcast. If someone described to you that a factory had been set up to mass produce tools and weapons and that attached to this factory there was a kitchen or canteen, then you'd probably accept this as a description of a modern day industrial area in any city or town around the world. But what if I said this factory was between 200 and 400,000 years old? Well, if you're a member of a team from the Tel Aviv University in Israel working at the Gatham Cave in the Samarian foothills just outside Tel Aviv, try doing that in one breath, this is just what they have found. It's believed that the cave was originally created by the action of acidic water on the limestone rock. Some sort of seismic event then opened the entrance to the cavern over 200,000 years ago to allow local inhabitants of the late Paleolithic period to start up their massive tool production before closing up again and sealing in their secrets until construction work, which started recently on a highway widening project, opened again. I was so excited by that I forgot where I was. The area is surrounded by large quantities of flint, and the tools made there were of very high quality, covering all stages from hunting the prey to precise butchering, having one sharp edge and one blunt one so they could be held comfortably. The inhabitants were part of the Ahuli-Yabrudian cultural complex, which was restricted to the area now known as Jordan, Israel, Lebanon and Syria. Little is known of these toolmakers, who were an early forerunner to Homo sapiens, and they are only represented by a few teeth which have so far been discovered. But this discovery has pushed back the boundaries of modern man's existence in the area to over 200,000 years. There's still considerable work to do in the caves, and it's hoped that more human remains can be found to give more knowledge and insight into these ancient industrial pioneers. Now, a lovely piece from Australia. It takes a few moments to get your eyes in, and then leaping out of the sun-baked rocks, you can spot engravings of kangaroos, dugongs, emus, turtles, birds and mythical beasts, complex geometric patterns, warriors with boomerangs and bush turkeys. The small unfenced valley in the northwest corner of Australia, marked by nothing more than a rusty metal sign, contains more ancient rock art than the whole of Paleolithic Europe. Despite these riches, the Pilbara is probably the most remote coastal region in Australia. It's as large as Spain, but only has 40,000 residents and is almost completely unvisited by tourists. Instead, this bleak, spectacularly rugged land is devoted to a kind of wealth called mining. A region bearing a unique record of human culture stretching back over 30,000 years is now home to some of the newest settlements in Australia, air-conditioned towns humming with iron ore and offshore gas industries. A short drive takes us across salt flats to the peninsula and views of the 42 arid islands of the Dampier Archipelago. Here lies one of the world's biggest collections of ancient art. It's estimated that there are over 1 million rock engravings on the peninsula, with 4,000 examples in the deep gorge alone, where you can examine art that's been created up to 30,000 years ago. It's no idle boast that this is the richest area for petroglyphs anywhere in the world, says Ken Mulvaney, a cultural heritage specialist with mining company Rio Tinto, and the only person with a PhD on the rock art of the archipelago. This art is done for a number of purposes, he says. Some of it is just to tell stories, some is identifying your presence in the area, some is hunting magic, and some has mythological associations. We seem to have an elaborate design from the start, he says. They were highly sophisticated people and even had a better lifestyle. It's a lovely warm climate to be in. A jobless Bulgarian man scraping a living by hunting for scrap metal has uncovered a haul of Bronze Age treasure worth over 1.5 million euros. The 42-year-old discovered the trove of jewellery, coins and tools potentially dating back 4,000 years among the roots of a tree in the northern town of Svechetov. Under Bulgarian law, such relics are now the property of the state. The major discovery significantly enhances our knowledge of the Bronze Age in the area. Two bronze axes, several pieces of gold jewellery and six gold coins make up the cache discovered earlier this month. You have to ask why he was looking for scrap metal beneath a tree. But anyway, that's just me asking questions as usual. Best not to ask questions, Mr. Connolly. Let's move on. In an intriguing original look at the history of the first Americans, a new study finds evidence that the north-south orientation of the American continents slowed the spread of populations and technology compared to the east-west axis of Eurasia. The research by Sohina Ramachandran and Noah Rosenberg from Brown University and Stanford University uses genetic information to explore the effects of continental axes and climates on human migration and adaptation across the Americas. It's been proposed that the east-west orientation of the Eurasian landmass aided the rapid spread of ancient technological innovations, while the north-south orientation of the Americas led to a slower diffusion of technology. The research develops this idea, arguing that continental orientation influenced migration patterns and played an important role in determining the structure of human genetic variation and the distribution and spread of cultural traits. To test this hypothesis, the team analysed genetic variation data from 6 to 8 populations, 39 from Eurasia and 29 from the Native Americans. The data was used to identify relationships between the genetic and geographic distances between populations on each continent. The research supports the idea that technological diffusion was accelerated across Eurasia because populations with the same latitude experience similar climates, making adaptation to new locations much easier. Whereas migrating along lines of longitude involves adapting to new climates. And it's our Stonehenge story of the week. You see, I've lost my buzz on this one, but I'm going to strive on anyway. An archaeological treasure trove has been unearthed by a team from the Open University and could transform our understanding of Stonehenge. The most significant artifacts uncovered are two carved ducks, the first of their kind to be found in Britain. The ducks were likely, say the team, to be the result of Bronze Age tradition of carving animal figurines that were then thrown into water as offerings. But while the ducks date back to 700 BCE, a ceremonial dagger was also found, which was twice as old. And guess what that is? Yes, 1400 BCE. However, another item which the team of diggers initially believed was a cow's tooth, which was revealed by radiocarbon date to date back to around 6250 BCE, some 3,000 years before work began on Stonehenge. I'm just thinking there, actually. 700 BCE to 1400 BCE is not twice as old, actually. It's 700 years older. So before you write in, I've worked it out myself. Anyway, all this was a tranche of more than 200 animal bones that were buried alongside evidence of a large fire, suggesting a Mesolithic feast for up to 100 people. The bones transpired not to be from cows, but instead from aurochs, a now extinct animal about the size of a buffalo. Further excavations revealed that a hoard of more than 5,500 work flints and tools. Given that only a few Mesolithic items had ever previously been found around Stonehenge, the discovery is strong evidence of the continuity of human life at the site. This means Stonehenge could have been a site of great significance to humans for several thousands of years before the monument was built. It's not a surprise because we know that there was a Mesolithic monument there somewhere because of the totem posts that had been found during the excavation of the car park several years ago. The massive missing link between these two things has been that there's no evidence of them until now. Mr. David Jacks, who runs the course on Roman history, I kid you not, Roman history, used his university students to excavate at the northeast of the Iron Age hill fort known as Vespasian's Camp. Digging down into the bed of a former spring revealed the artifacts. The team began its excavations at the privately owned land in 2005 and has relied on council and English Heritage funding. It's now hoping to attract more funds to support further work. Survey work now at the Loch of Stennes in Orkney, Scotland, has revealed what could be a massive prehistoric monument lying underwater to the south of the Ring of Brodgar. The underwater anomaly has come to light in a project looking at prehistoric sea level changes in Orkney. The project's called The Rising Tide, Submerged Landscape of Orkney, and is a collaboration between the universities of St Andrews, Wales, Dundee, Bangor and Aberdeen. Although it's tempting to speculate that the ring-shaped feature which lies just off the loch shore is the remains of a henge, or perhaps even a prehistoric quarry, at this stage the project leaders are urging caution. Very good. Orkney-based archaeologist Caroline Wickham-Jones, hello there, a lecturer at the University of Aberdeen, explained that the preliminary results are suggesting that there is an unusual object in the shallow water just off the shore, but more work is needed before they will identify or even confirm whether it's natural or man-made. Dr. Richard Bates from the School of Geosciences in St Andrews added, the character and size of this feature, approximately 90 metres in diameter, are about the size of the main ring of Brodgar. If it turns out to be artificial, the massive anomaly has to predate the influx of the sea into the Stennes Loch Basin. When prehistoric Orcadians started to build the stone circles in Stennes, the landscape would have been very different to what it is today, and the sea would have been about a metre below current levels. Even then, the impact of the rising water in the Loch of Stennes was a bit slower. They think it was a gradual incursion of the sea over time, preceded by a number of storm events that eventually saw seawater crash over the rock lip and begin to form what is now the Loch of Stennes. Well, this is a story I think we'll have to keep an eye on, and I hope we can come back to it and confirm whether or not it is man-made or not. You can see actually some lovely pictures of this on the Past Horizons website right now. Now to Sri Lanka, where a series of stone tools dating back to the Paleolithic period have been unearthed in the Jaffna Peninsula. The discovery has been confirmed by Dr. Shiran Deraniyangali, an expert in the prehistoric periods. Paleolithic artefacts have been found in locations in South India, South Asia and Africa. However, this is the first time in Sri Lanka's history that such objects have been found relating to the Paleolithic period. These finds were made in a place called Manikakai, close to Point Pedro. This was in 1984. However, due to a 30-year civil war, excavation came to a halt, making it impossible to unearth further evidence. No prehistoric evidence was found in Jaffna up to now. The department has now decided to start excavations in the area. Now a lovely story. Stone Age toddlers may have attended a former prehistoric nursery where they were encouraged to develop their creative skills in cave art, say archaeologists. Research indicates young children express themselves in an ancient form of finger painting. Archaeologists at one of the most famous prehistoric decorated caves in France, known as the Cave of 100 Mammoths, the complex of caverns at Ruffignac in the Dordogne, have discovered that children were actively helped to express themselves through finger fluting, which is running fingers over soft red clay to produce decorative crisscrossing lines, zigzags and swirls. The stunning drawings by adults include 158 depictions of mammoths, 28 bisons, 15 horses, 12 goats, 10 woolly rhino, and 4 human figures, as well as 1 bear. They just form a small proportion of the art that's found in the 5-mile cave system. The presence of children's art was first revealed in 2006 by archaeologist Leslie Van Gelder of Walden University in the USA and her husband, Kevin Sharp. The majority of the drawings are flutings covering the walls and roofs of the many galleries and passages in the complex. One chamber is so rich in flutings by children, it's believed to be an area set aside specifically for them. The marks of 4 children, estimated to be aged between 2 and 7 years old, have been identified there. Jess Cooney, a PhD student at the university's archaeology department, suggests it was a special place for children. Adults were there, but the vast majority of the artwork is by children. She thinks this particular chamber is where children were encouraged to make more art than adults. It could have been a playroom where the children gathered, or a room where they practiced, where they were encouraged, in fact, to make marks in order that they could grow into artists themselves and make beautiful paintings that you find throughout the cave. Or it could have been a room used for a ritual for particular children, perhaps some sort of initiation ceremony. Fluting is thought to be that by a 5-year-old girl and the most prolific throughout the cave. Work by 4 adults has also been identified, though it is possible there were 2 further adults present. The juxtaposition of the flutings of individuals indicate the relationships between the cave dwellers, the researchers say. For example, the markings show that 1 7-year-old girl was most often in the company of the smallest of the adults, they call it, possibly a male and possibly, shall we say, an older brother. Some of the children's flutings are high up on the walls and on the ceiling, so they must have been held up or been sitting on somebody's shoulders to be able to make them. Flutings by a 2-year-old suggest the child's hand were guided by an adult. The art shows us that this is not an activity where children were running amok. It shows collaboration between children and adults encouraging children to make these marks. This was a communal activity. The significance of finger fluting, also found in other caves in France, Spain, New Guinea and Australia, has been widely debated in archaeological circles. Some regard the marks as doodlings, prehistoric graffiti, while others suggest ritual. Cooney says the object of her research was to allow prehistoric children to have a voice, because so much archaeological research focuses on men's activities. What she found in Rufignac is that the children are screaming from the walls to be heard. Their presence is everywhere. And in fact, there's a 5-year-old girl there constantly shouting out down the millennia, "I want to paint. I want to paint." That's a lovely sentiment. Now, a sadder one here. Looters are taking advantage of dropping area lake levels in Texas to find long-hidden artifacts, and that's creating a big problem for the authorities. Since Lake Whitney's water level dropped, 5 sites full of Native American artifacts are now accessible for the first time in decades. Some of these sites date back more than 8,000 years. It's against federal law to remove any Native American artifact from government property, and in Texas, doing that also violates the State Antiquities Code. But in the past few months, authorities say that they have caught more than 30 people digging illegally. Once the damage has been done to the sites, the effects are nearly impossible to reverse. In one area, looters even broke concrete open, burrowed under it, and then sifted through the dirt, taking what they could and leaving behind the rest. What shame on them. More than 10,000 years ago, before settled agriculture and the rise of civilization, hunter-gatherers were erecting and carving great T-shaped monolithic pillars weighing as much as 20 metric tons atop a mountain ridge in present-day Turkey, using nothing more than simple flint tools. Excavations about who these people were and why they built these monumental structures remain, for the moment, unanswered. Only 5% of the site where these stones were placed has been excavated by archaeologists, so it's a bit early to draw any major conclusions. The site of Göbekli Tepe, considered the oldest known set of religious structures in the world, its evidence suggests that hunter-gatherers were capable of conceiving and building monumental complexes. As a site excavator, Dr. Klaus Schmidt of the German Archaeological Institute says that first came the temple, then came the city. He suggests that the site was not a settlement, but rather a sanctuary or centre where communities met to perform religious rites. supporting this by pointing out that the excavations to date have not provided any evidence of residential buildings or fortifications. More needs to be done before this theory can be substantially supported, but while the excavation and research chugs along, a team of conservationists are pushing forward with plans to protect, conserve and showcase the site for posterity. The Global Heritage Fund, a non-profit conservation organization based in Palo Alto in California, the site and its extant remains are threatened, they say, by looting, exposure and insufficient management of the site and its resources. As a case in point, just over a year ago, a 30-kilo stela was removed from the site by looters, closing the site for 11 days. Moreover, erosion of the exposed structures caused by the natural freeze-thaw cycle continue to affect the original integrity and the structural surfaces and carvings. Now the Global Heritage Fund, with the help of the Turkish government and other institutions and organisations, is spearheading an effort to address all these issues. If it is decided to excavate new areas, then additional conservation and shelter funding has to be secured. One of the most pressing issues is the repair of broken stelae. As the construction of a shelter to protect the site is an urgent need, shelter design proposals are being submitted from six different firms under the direction of the German Archaeological Institute. The shelter, once constructed, will be designed so as to minimise site impact by installing it directly onto bedrock to support an overhanging roof structure. Hanging visitor walkways will be constructed to allow visitors a clear view of the remains without the adverse effects produced by physical contact. Structural support will be established to stabilise the monuments, including a number of the stelae. Along the way, the organisations hope to be able to assist Turkish authorities in securing World Heritage site inscription for Göbekli Tepe. And as for the advancing research, it may be likely that much of the site will be left indefinitely unexcavated, preserving what remains for future inquiry and discovery when better, non-intrusive methods have been developed. You can also read an interesting juxtaposition to that story. Again, yes, I'm going to tell you, in Past Horizons, www.pasthorizons.com. It's a very recent story. Now, Israel returns Bronze Age pottery to Jordan. Jordan says that Israel has now returned 620 early Bronze Age pottery items taken in the 1960s by a US archaeologist for research at a Jerusalem-based institute. Israel returned the items, including pots, plates and jars, in April. American archaeologist Paul Lapp borrowed them back in the 1960s for study and research. Acting director of Jordan's Antiquities Department, Faris Hmoud, told the state-run news agency. Hmoud said the antiquities will be displayed at a museum in the Jordan Valley. Jordan is also demanding the return of the Dead Sea Scrolls, also known as the Qumran manuscripts, which contain some of the earliest biblical texts. The oldest documents date back to the 3rd century BCE, while the latest was written around 70 CE. Israel claims the scrolls from a museum in East Jerusalem, which was then under Jordanian sovereignty, but was occupied during that 1967 Six-Day War. If only people could just get along. Now, good news. Prehistoric archaeological sites in northern Mexico's Bandelier National Monument have reopened to visitors 3 months after the largest wildfire in the state's recorded history. The monument's visitor center and a largest concentration of prehistoric cultural sites survived the fire and later the flooding that sent ash and sediment and charred debris into the heart of the monument. Hazardous conditions kept the site off limit for weeks. Sites at Frijoles Canyon include the kivas, which are round subterranean ceremonial meeting places dug into the canyon floor, and the stone walls that surround them. There's also the wildflowers that have grown over the area and the dwellings carved into the canyon walls by the ancestors of modern Native Americans. Tucked into the northern New Mexico's ancient canyons, Bandelier has a long human history that stretches back more than 10,000 years. Unbelievably, nearly two-thirds of the monument was scorched during the La Conchas fire, which started on the 26th of June this year after a tree fell on an electricity transmission line miles away. Flames raced across the mesa tops and down canyons dotted with hundreds of archaeological sites. The 630 square kilometre blaze reduced entire mountainsides to ash. all but 400 hectares of the 4,800 hectare Upper Friuli's watershed burned, leaving no vegetation behind. Now, the Caithness Archaeological Trust is currently in the process of reconstructing a full-size broch in Spittal Quarry, Caithness. The idea is to construct the broch and then knock down a section of it to understand how they collapse. It's hoped that this will help archaeologists to uncover ruined brochs in the future. The project is called Stoneworks Early Architectural Project. The idea is to develop items in specific locations in the, to deposit items in specific locations in the broch wall as it is constructed and then see where they eventually end up when it's collapsed. In addition to the broch construction, CAT will also be carrying out traditional skills workshops, children's activities, guided walks and talks. The Caithness Archaeological Trust was set up in 2002 to promote all aspects of archaeology in Caithness and to re-engage the local residents with their heritage. They're working alongside other local organisations, the Archie Sinclair Fossil Centre, which has an exhibition run by Caithness residents housing a collection of fossils of the local flagstone industry. Also involved in the project is the AOC Archaeology Group, whose officer Charlotte Douglas is quoted as saying, "We'd really love to see more volunteers on site of any age. Volunteers are welcome to turn up on site and when they please. No registration or commitment is required, but all assistance gratefully received." The sessions end on the 15th of October, so you've still got time, 9 to 5 daily apart from Sundays. To take part or get more information, contact Derek of Caithness Archaeological Trust on email at caithnessarchaeology.org.uk or give him a phone on 01593 731 269. Not often you get a chance to build a broch. Now, archaeologists in Jackson Hole in Wyoming have been racing against time to complete excavations before a highway widening program is undertaken. The excavations, led by Wyoming's State Archaeologist Office, started in the summer of 2010 at the mouth of Game Creek, and already they have more than 40,000 artifacts. Oh, you've got a big enough finds bag there. The earliest find so far is a fire pit, which has been dated to around 8,000 BCE, but accompanying arrowheads and spearheads that would corroborate the dating have yet to be found. At the time of this fire pit, the climate in the area compared to today was warmer and wetter in summer and colder and drier in the winter. The impact of this is that the summers would have produced more forage, which in turn would have sustained greater numbers and variety of fauna, leading to a sustained and larger population. The drier winters could also have contributed to the forage bank, but speculation on the year-round occupancy is just that, speculation. Considerable analysis of the artifacts is still required to either prove or disprove the theory, including analysis of the animal bones discovered, which could reveal the time of year when they were killed. It's hoped to expand the excavations next year to the west of the road, where an even higher density of artifacts has been found. Now, archaeologists and conservationists are fighting a vital battle to preserve what could be the most important archaeological sites in Jordan. The area in question is known as the Azraq Oasis. 20,000 years ago, the area was blessed with an abundance of water. This environment encouraged a plethora of flora and fauna, on the back of which a thriving human community developed. Climate change then took over, and the area is now a rapidly drying marshland, reducing in size to a small oasis. The occupants of this epipaleolithic site, who predate Neolithic humans, were adept farmers as well as hunters and developed social skills which could translate themselves into village and town communities. A combined team from the Jordanian Department of Antiquities and University College London, as well as the University of Cambridge, carried out extensive excavations from 2005 to 2007, which yielded extensive data, and several articles and papers have been published in academic journals. One particular find, however, stood out, a complete skeleton, unusual for the area and the period, bound and buried. The unusual nature is twofold. Firstly, few human remains have been found in the area, but a normal burial leaving the body exposed on the ground to enable natural recycling is what to be expected. So an actual burial led the team to believe that a simple form of class structure had developed. The second unusual nature was the actual burial itself. The body had been placed in a crouched upright position, and this was the first example of its type in Jordan. Further DNA analysis of the remains are being carried out, and it's hoped that more secrets will be unlocked. There is severe pressure on the site, however, not only from the degrading and drying of the geography of the area, but probably a more dangerous threat, the spread of modern development. I have to say, I spent about 20 years ago, spent some lovely times around Azraq. It is an amazing place, both for the natural history as well as the archaeology. Now, Associate Professor Rustam Aslan, head of Troy excavations, announced that a prehistoric settlement had been found in the Dardanelles, a narrow strait in northwest Turkey, connecting the Aegean to the Sea of Marmara. "We have found a prehistoric settlement dating back 5,000 BCE, said Aslan. If true, such claims would make the settlement one of the oldest in the region, outdating even the ancient city of Troy, an ancient centre of Mediterranean trade." Well, of course, that's if there really is a Troy. I have yet actually to see a signpost saying, "Welcome to Troy." Anyway, that's my tuppence in. Let's move on. The archaeology team examined the coast from the entrance of the Dardanelles to Çanakkale city centre. They already knew about all the settlements older than 5,000 years ago established on high plateaus. Professor Aslan lamented that the slowly rising sea level had already claimed as much as 90% of the site. Extensive ruins of the city nonetheless remain, and archaeologists have uncovered pottery and other artefacts that hint the city may have once been an ancient trade hub. The discovery of the settlement will be a crucial piece in interpreting the Dardanelles' prehistoric past, about which the archaeologists still know very little. Now, finally, a rock bearing what is believed to be a rare piece of art dating back to the Bronze Age has been discovered on an outcrop alongside a medieval pilgrim route in West Kerry in Ireland. The discovery 2 weeks ago of a perfect spiral on a rock on the Dingle Peninsula is being assessed by county archaeologist Michael Connolly. Measuring 19.5 centimetres, it was found by local man Colm Bambury near the foot of Mount Brandon. The area is dotted with standing stones, ogham and beehive huts and other monuments from early Christianity. The drawing is believed to be thousands of years old, and follow-up investigations by Mr. Connolly found indications of Bronze Age enclosures in the immediate vicinity. Well, on that note, and a hello to another archaeologist called Connolly, there seems to be a lot of us about, we'll end this week's news. But don't forget that our news is available on that iPhone, iPod Touch and iPad. Have a look at stonepages.com/APP. And of course, keep up to date with Past Horizons. All the best. www.pasthorizons.com. And of course, for archaeology tools, there ain't no other better place to buy your tools from. Remember, of course, more can always be found at stonepages, news.stonepages.com. Thank you again for listening to Archaeology News 201. We hope you'll return again to us next week.